Hey, how long does it get take to get into the Pentagon without a badge?
Depends
Months.
On a yes.
You gotta have.
You mean like to rob it?
You gotta go.
Yeah,
through, you have
yeah.
to have
yeah.
a security clearance.
No, I have a meeting, and I usually have that beautiful blue badge that I just.
Oh
walk
no!
Up.
Now you have to
yeah.
go with
yeah.
your two
Why?
Forms of ID. Well, if there's not like a tour guide or like horrible children trying to get in,
it doesn't take
tourists,
that long.
Doesn't
as
that long
as there's not a line.
Wait, I'm sorry. The line for people having meetings is the same for tourists.
Oh
and children?
Yes. Oh, you get to go through. Listen, no blue badge, lady. You get to go through the hoi polloi line now, just like
just
all
like
the
rest
the
of
rest
us.
Of
and
us.
Welcome and, to your post government experience.
And there's a special like expedited line for the horrible children.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Hackers, Heart Patients, and Hellfire Edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Daily Beast. We're in Washington, where it's about as hot as hellfire right now.
Yeah,
it is indeed.
I had to go to Georgetown today, in a little administrative detail in connection with the class that I'm teaching. And
the Handmaidens of Power.
We'll get to that in the object lesson section. But I, from the time I left my car to the time I had to wander around campus a little to find where I was going, to the time I got back to my car, I was drenched in sweat and realized that I'm really ready for summer to be over.
Yeah.
You know, we complain because it's cold. We complain because it's humid. Now we're complaining that it's hot.
I never complain that it's cold.
We're going to complain that it's cold again. I like these late summer days because they're not incredibly muggy. We don't have lots of thunder showers. Yeah, it's hot, so you go in the shade if you want to. And this is going to stretch into a long, sunny fall that we will all enjoy until
so
it
nice.
Ends and we'll forget it ever happened.
Yeah. All right, Pollyanna, we get it.
Well, that's your weather report for today. I'm joined, as always, by my friends Ben Wittes, Susan Hennessy, and Tamara Kaufman-Wittes. And this week, we have a special surprise guest, maybe the best surprise guest we've ever had on the podcast, I'm just going to say.
Definitely the most important surprise
Definitely most
guest.
Important. And I think it's fair to say this person who has probably listened to every, not only every single podcast, but probably more than anyone else has listened to every podcast. You hear this person's name every week. Ben, would you like to introduce our special guest?
Our special guest this week is the most excellent longtime friend, Jen Patya Howell. Best known
Hooray.
To listeners of this show as its producer and editor, but has these whole other lives, including being force behind much or all of the programming at James Madison's Montpelier, which is the historic home plantation of James Madison. And I have worked with Jen for it's got to be close to 10 years now. On one project or another, as Brookings has worked with Montpelier on lots of fun stuff. So welcome, Jen. This is actually the first time you've ever actually been to a taping of the show, right?
Yeah, I can't believe it's been a year and a half, and this is the first time I get to see your smiling faces when you record the podcast. So I'm super excited to be here.
We have scotch.
Yes, scotch is very important, and I'm going to just be making funny faces at everyone the whole time to make you crack.
Well, we're going to turn to you for key commentary throughout the episode.
She's usually like, we're going to cut that part.
Yeah, that just remember that Jen
Shane,
is
that
the one who
stupid.
Gets to edit this when it's all done. So
I'm going to edit everything
she
to make
holds
it look like
the
you
power.
Gave the question. Yeah, yeah. You answered all the questions.
So here's the thing to listeners. If you get through this episode and you hear a lot of Jen, then you'll know that she didn't edit much. And if you hear no further word from Jen, you'll know that this episode was severely cut. Right, Jen?
That's absolutely correct.
All right. Well, this week on the podcast, new details emerge about Americans held hostage by Islamic militants. Security researchers use an unorthodox approach to protecting medical devices. And the U.S. kills ISIS's number two. Does it matter? Plus, we'll have object lessons. Of course, our best object lesson is here, Jen. So we'll try and live up to that standard for you. Thanks for your special appearance. Let's start with this story about hostages. Actually, two in the past week, sort of important stories about Americans being held hostage by militants came out. One was this really kind of just powerhouse report by James Gordon Meek and Brian Ross and the investigative team over at ABC News, revealing, among other things, the proof of life video that was recorded by Kayla Mueller, who, of course, was a hostage we've talked about a number of times on the show, who was held by ISIS and died in ISIS custody. Still, circumstances around her death were, have been disputed by both sides. But what this ABC News report really makes clear is that messages were being sent back on her behalf. It's a really heart-wrenching, actually, thing to have to watch, but I think really important. And also really kind of an indictment, I think it's fair to say, of Doctors Without Borders and failing to intercede. We can talk about that and whether that was the right thing to do on her behalf to try and actually get her back. And really taking some shots and some criticism at the administration's hostage policy, which has kind of undergone this revamp now, and many people are questioning whether it has been for naught or whether it's actually producing results. To wit, this week also we saw another video come out from Caitlin Coleman, who is an American woman who's being held along with her Canadian husband, Josh Boyle, by the Haqqani Network. She's actually given birth to two sons while they're in captivity. So there's a family of four over there, and a lot of questions being asked about what's being done to get them back. I'd love to get your guys' take. I guess let's start with Kayla Mueller's, you know, story, and you know, why, let's first talk about like why this matters that it is still coming out now. I mean, that we've kind of forgotten maybe to some degree about the ISIS hostages. That was a while ago. There have thankfully not been any other Americans held captive. But what did we learn from this, and what does it? Why is it important to be hearing this story now, do you think?
Well, so I think there's sort of two parts that are really interesting and should be taken sort of distinctly. One is sort of the telling of the story of what a remarkable human being Kayla Mueller was. I mean, really sort of the account of her sort of bravery and grace under that kind of pressure is, I think, just a testament to her and important to tell that story because, you know, people matter. And I think it's a tribute to who she was as a person. You know, then there's also this other question of Doctors Without Borders conduct that is a more it's difficult to confront. So in essence, Doctors Without Borders, because Kayla Mueller was not one of their employees.
But she was on a trip with one of their employees when she was taken.
Right.
In a Doctors Without Borders vehicle.
Yeah.
Right. They declined to intercede on her behalf. She was taken with other Doctors Without Borders employees. Once those employees were rescued, Doctors Without Borders no longer participated. And I think far more egregiously, the revelations that Doctors Without Borders was given information, including an email address that Kayla Mueller's family was supposed to use to contact ISIS, that they withheld from the family for 7 weeks. You know, I mean, look, we can talk about the specifics and we should, but I do think this is sort of, it's an interesting contrast because, you know, Doctors Without Borders has taken, really a tone of righteousness on a lot of issues, right? So attacks, you know, the U.S. airstrike on their medical facility in Afghanistan, for example, you know, really talking about the accountability and decency and importance and, you know, undeniably they have a really, really important mission. They do incredibly important work. Sort of to contrast that not only with the actual actions that they took, but also the sort of the self-justifying and frankly victim blaming, right? She wasn't our employee. She wasn't supposed to be there. If we'd known she was there, we would have told her not to be there. I really think that it's a black eye for the institution.
Well, you know, they do call it Doctors Without Borders, not Doctors Without Tribal Identity. And I think the behavior of the institution here really is a sort of circle wagoning, wagon circling behavior you associate with institutions under pressure And I think they looked at this situation and they said, is she one of ours? No. And, you know, that was where they saw their responsibility as ending. And I think the interesting thing about that is that that's not the posture of the organization with respect to, you know, whoever the victim community is in, you know, they don't say about civilians in Afghanistan, well, they're not, you know, employees of us. Right. So therefore we don't serve them.
I think you're missing something important here. I don't think this is about bureaucratic organizational wagon circling. I think this is about precisely their self-righteousness and their sense that their mission outweighs the fate of any Westerner who signs up to work with them or just goes along to help them. Because what they did was not merely refuse to negotiate on behalf of Kayla Mueller with the rest of their employees, not merely retain and not transmit this information that their employees, when released, brought out with them for Kayla Mueller's family, but they also failed in giving a security briefing to two of their other employees who were going into the same area just months after these Doctors Without Borders people were taken. They did not tell those employees that there had been previous kidnappings. In fact, they told them, according to the ABC News report, that they didn't need to be worried about abductions going into this area. And that, to me, in some ways, is the most revealing failing of all of their horrific failings with respect to this incident, because it shows me that they care more about getting people in to do the job than they care about the people who sign up on behalf of that job to work with them. And I think that, you know, people are taking on risk to work with Doctors Without Borders, and of course they do that knowingly, but they also do that on the assumption that the institution at some level takes their interests, their safety into account. And I think this ABC report has done tremendous harm to Doctors Without Borders' ability to recruit and retain staff when this is how they treated their own employees.
I would just like to say, you know, I sometimes sit here and play Shane's sparring partner on matters related to the behavior of media organizations. But I do think this is an example of where no self-respecting media organization would have behaved this way. And, you know, this behavior stands in really sharp contrast to the way organizations like the New York Times and Reuters and the Washington Post have behaved when people associated with them, including, you know, people
Stringers,
right. They're fixers, they're, you know, contract photographers. I mean, people, they're just kind of working with drivers, you know, have gotten into trouble, and press organizations have been really bulldoggy and aggressive in trying to protect those people. And I think it's interesting that a human rights protector organization and a humanitarian relief organization doesn't play in that way at all.
But I also think it raises sort of an interesting factual question, not just about Doctors Without Borders policy, but actually about the U.S. sort of policy towards hostages. And that is that it seems like Doctors Without Borders essentially adopts the position that engaging in negotiations for non-employees further imperils their employees, right? It makes it more likely that individuals are going to be kidnapped. This roughly aligns with sort of the U.S. policy of not negotiating for hostages, not paying ransom, the idea being that if you pay ransom, that only incentivizes further kidnappings. It's actually a criminal offense to pay ransom, although it has not been prosecuted. I think this, like, it raises a weird question for a lot of people of is this the right way to think about it, right? Does it actually increase risk? And also, are these kinds of policies right as sort of a matter of first principle?
But wait a minute. I think the analogy is really bad there. No one was asking Doctors Without Borders to pay a ransom for Kayla Mueller. People were asking for the sort of interventions and intercessions that they would have engaged in had she been an employee, or short of that, for the courtesy of passing on contacts and the ability to conduct conversations, you know, that you would expect people to do out of kind of human decency. And so I think if it had been, you know, a question of like an ISIS demand that they rejected for X amount of money, I don't think they'd be getting the same criticism that they're getting right now.
Well, this also, and I think to Susan's question, I mean, what more can be done? What should we be doing? And I think the administration's approach has been, well, it is, that no ransom, but negotiation, there's something short of ransom or that's not ransom that we're willing to engage in. So the two big efforts that have been stood up is there's now an envoy and a deputy envoy for hostage policy at the State Department. And then there's this thing called the FBI Fusion Cell, which is supposed to kind of gather all the intelligence and the leads across government, but also be the interface to the families. But when you talk to people about how that's going, it's not entirely clear to me if there's a lot more things we could be doing that we just aren't, or if there really, at least in some of these cases, just that aren't that many things we could do. It's definitely the case that with the prisoners with the Haqqani network, like Caitlin Coleman and Josh Boyle and their kids, Haqqani has signaled many, many times that it's open to ransom payments. It's signaling that it's open to prisoner exchanges. They want to negotiate. It's debatable, I think, in some people's minds whether ISIS ever wanted to negotiate and what we could have done. But, you know, Ben, I agree with you and with everyone else is saying too. I mean, there is just a basic level of courtesy and common decency involved with passing along information to the family, because frankly, it's the family's right, in my opinion, and I think the administration would back them up on this, to decide how they want to engage. And the administration has said publicly now, we will not prosecute anyone for paying a ransom. We can't say that it's legal because it's not, but we won't prosecute them. And importantly, the ISIS families believe that they were told by a senior White House NSC official, you will be prosecuted if you do this. So, you know, I think the administration is trying as best it can now to sort of do what it can through diplomatic channels for people who are willing to negotiate, but basically say to the families, you know, well, they're not saying it's all on you, but a lot of it actually is on the families. But, you know, to try and to some degree maybe empower them to do something about this. I don't know what more could have been done for Kayla Mueller, but, I mean, Jesus, they never even gave her the chance if they're not handing over this information.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. But I also think that one of the striking things about ISIS and the longer that they've been around and the more that we've seen them operate, the more we understand just how many people, Iraqis, Syrians, as well as third country nationals who come through their territory, they have kidnapped. And they've used for a variety of purposes. Yeah, some of them they ransom. Some of them they use as sex slaves for their fighters. Some of them they use as cannon fodder on the battlefield. Some of them they use for propaganda purposes by beheading them on videos. And, you know, so there is a really multifaceted, multidimensional function in the ISIS universe for hostages. And I think that that means we can't necessarily draw any conclusions from this one instance for how U.S. policy should approach the issue. And I think it also points to just how tough this is, just what a tough policy dilemma this is for governments who find their nationals in this position. Nobody wants to be there, and no government wants to be there. And, you know, you say that at this point, the U.S. government would probably back these families up on the idea that it's their right to decide how to engage. But it seems to me that that's something that has come from the policy shifts that we've seen over the last couple of years. I'm not sure that that would have been the stance of previous U.S. governments in previous instances. They would have said, no, it's the sovereign right of the United States to decide how to do this.
I think that's right. Okay, well, sad stories. Hopefully happier endings to come for those still being held hostage. Let's move on to this is one of the weirder cybersecurity stories I think we've talked about in a little while. Susan, you're going to give us the recap on this, but security researchers discovered a flaw in medical devices, heart pacemakers.
Yep.
And rather than go to the manufacturer to get it patched up, did something never one's ever really tried before. What happened?
This is certainly an interesting story. So this is a group of security researchers working for MedSec, which is a sort of cybersecurity startup. They research medical devices, right? So networked medical devices, including pacemakers and defibrillators. And they found a vulnerability in one of those devices that would allow them to actually turn it off remotely. Right?
It was a bad ticker.
Oh.
So you have a pacemaker implanted.
You're so welcome. Proud of yourself.
I am. Jen, don't edit that. Sorry.
This is serious business, Shane.
It is very serious.
So you have a pacemaker implanted, and they've now proven that they can sit down and turn it off remotely. This is obviously a big deal. Ordinarily, you would expect these kinds of researchers to go to St. Jude's Medical, which is the manufacturer, and let them know. They can try and obtain a bug bounty. They can try and do it to gain publicity. There's some minor gains to be had. In this case, MedSec did not do that. Instead, they went to an investment firm, Muddy Waters, which
the best name.
Is the great name.
The best name, especially for what is about to happen next.
Muddy Waters then takes a short position against St. Jude's stock, meaning that if St. Jude's stock falls, they stand to make additional money. They make a deal with these cybersecurity researchers that the more the stock falls, the more they will pay to these researchers for the information. And then they tell everyone, hey, that pacemaker that's in your heart right now, I can turn that off. And not surprisingly, St. Jude's shares actually did fall. So this is a pretty incredible thing. One, some really scary questions about the security of medical devices in general, which is something people have been talking about for a very long time in sort of a theoretical way, but we haven't quite seen this kind of manifestation yet. It's worth noting that they didn't announce how one might exploit the vulnerability, and they don't believe that it could be discovered. It took them months, and so they don't think there's any immediate risk to anybody right now. There's also a really some difficult questions about how exactly you incentivize research into medical devices, right? It took MedSec many months and a significant upfront investment to discover these vulnerabilities in the first place. If you want to incentivize that kind of research, there has to be a way to compensate for it.
They just found one.
They just found a really big one, right, which places a huge incentive on companies like St. Jude's, which has been criticized in the past for ignoring warnings about vulnerabilities in its products. It imposes a pretty significant financial penalty.
And did the reporters for Bloomberg that did this piece, did they say that in the past medical device manufacturers had not been terribly forthcoming about these flaws? And like, this is like, as a community, like some, it seems like some security researchers thought they weren't particularly receptive to the traditional means of pressuring them to fix the problem.
Right. They reference sort of a DHS report and also just kind of a general sense that when vulnerabilities have been reported to companies in the past, they do not take sort of remedial steps and instead attempt to hide the information, right?
But Susan, can I just ask, why isn't this, why shouldn't our reaction to this be, this is great? The vulnerability doesn't get disclosed in a fashion that can endanger everybody's health. The company pays a large stock price penalty for not maintaining first-rate cybersecurity. It will presumably now has a remarkable incentive to plug this vulnerability as quickly as possible, and
and it's not insider trading.
Right.
It's not inside information.
And so why shouldn't I look at this and say this is a great outcome?
This is the market working the way it's meant to work. Although, if I think about it in like game theory terms, like what kind of game is this medical security research firm playing? You know, the traditional game that you would expect it to play is blackmail, is to go to the device company and say, we know something. And
we're
going to
turn off all your patients'
hearts. Or we're going to make this public unless you pay us, right? And that would be a traditional business model for a cybersecurity
which does
company.
Happen.
It happens a lot. And we all seem to be okay with that in the world. But this is more like warlordism, right? This is their sort of, taking this, unique capability that they've, discovered or developed and putting themselves in the position of being able to elevate or crush various actors in the market by how they choose to behave with this unique capability.
Well, they could have done that before anyway, though.
Well, yeah, right.
Just nobody would have shorted it.
But, right, so they decided to really be a warlord, which is to use it to their own advantage and enrich somebody else along the way. But it's it's a different game than we're used to seeing in the market. I think that's why we're uncomfortable with
it. But I sort of feel like I'm not uncomfortable with it.
Of course you're not.
Well, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but I'm maybe even talking myself into believing this. Look, they've figured out how to monetize it, which incentivizes their good behavior and the research that you're talking about, and it disincentivized the bad behavior of having designed the insecure product. They've done it without blackmailing anybody. They've done it without threatening anybody's health.
But they didn't give the company a good faith opportunity to fix it on their own. Maybe that's why it feels so mean.
But why should they? They don't owe the company anything.
I think the response to this is because the standards of ethical research are supposed to prevent a lot of potentially really scary behavior. So if we sort of take this as acceptable behavior, right, that great, they found a way to have the market impose a cost. What's to stop, for example, somebody from discovering the same vulnerability and then selling individual people who have a device implanted in them the patch, right, and starting a whole secondary market? I think that, you know, look, we're talking about something that could kill a human being. And so I do think we have to think about, you know, autonomous vehicles, medical devices, stuff that, I mean, it really has the kind of direct connection to human lives differently than we think about, you know, email security or the other sort of cybersecurity threats we've seen.
So I totally agree with that. And I think you definitely, if you're doing research on the security of a medical device that is already implanted in large numbers of people, you have a very deep obligation to do that in a way that's not going to cause damage to those people. And that means, it seems to me, that you don't want to be dealing with the individuals because, number one, if you try to sell a patch to 50,000 individual consumers, large numbers of them aren't going to buy it. Some of them aren't going to afford it. The beef that you've identified is with the manufacturer, not with the individual patient. And you shouldn't be trying to extort something from the individual patient. On the other hand, I also don't like the idea that you go to the company and you threaten them. It's one thing if the company has a bug bounty program, but this company isn't responsible enough to have a bug bounty program even before they install large numbers of life-saving devices in people's hearts.
Right, but a bug bounty program, you know, at its max, it's going to pay out what Apple pays $50,000 for an exploitable vulnerability. Taking a market position against a massive corporation could net, I mean, we could be talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars.
Right, so again, I come back to, this seems elegant to me. The information doesn't get out to the public. No threat is made against the company. No threat is made against the individual patient. The researchers are very generously compensated for their efforts, and the company pays a significant regulatory penalty and develops a very substantial incentive to fix the problem. Why shouldn't we look at this and say, this is beautiful?
Okay, so I guess two points. One is a question. Does the U.S. government or does the public more broadly have any interest that is implicated by that business model? Because maybe it's just elegant, given the incentives you created. But maybe there's some dimension of market volatility or a vulnerability to individuals that that is impinged upon by this. But the second question is really the one I don't know the answer to, and maybe we'll see in the coming months. How many medical device companies became more responsible and or hired this cybersecurity research firm in the wake of this incident? And how many of them looked at that and said, oh my God, you know, we have to do something to protect our stock dealings. In other words, the incentive it creates might not be about cybersecurity. The incentive it creates might have something more to do with the way these companies are positioned in the market. And that doesn't solve the cybersecurity problem.
Look, I think at the end of the day, we're seeing more evidence of the fact that the U.S. government does not know how it wants to deal with major cybersecurity issues, right? It's sort of taken this, it's punted for years and years and years. Sort of voluntary information standards and a little bit with regulated entities.
This is voluntary information sharing.
Right, but when the government...
This is like...
Very selective and it's voluntary information sharing.
On steroids.
Right, but look, I think that the... this is a, you know, evidence that whenever there is a vacuum and sort of a market failure in the area, either the market will come up with its own solution, which we may or may not be comfortable with, or there's a need for some sort of regulatory response. I mean, for me, the real sort of concern is MedSec's representation that because it took them months to identify and exploit the vulnerability, it's going to take other people months to identify and exploit the vulnerability. So I'm sensitive to this particular argument because it's the exact argument used against NSA, which I would presume has significantly more capabilities than a cybersecurity startup,
worry now that Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear are working on pacemaker vulnerabilities.
Says, this person, the researcher, literally says, "We see no evidence of an immediate threat." Well, what if you're wrong?
Right.
Right? What happens?
What if you're not so smart, pal?
Do we get to charge you with murder? Like, what are sort of the stop gaps here? Ordinarily, whenever we're talking about things that are really, really important to safety, so, you know, drugs, automobiles, that's an area in which we expect to see a strong regulatory regime in order to incentivize particular types of behavior. We haven't done that with cybersecurity whenever it starts to interact with those areas. So I think my instinct is this is not an area in which we should say, hey, there's a beautiful market solution, but say, hey, whenever the market's coming up with uncomfortable solutions, that's the time to really wield strong regulatory authority.
How much money did they make off this?
We'll see how low the stock goes.
So this is out now, and this just keeps going.
It had fallen 4% at the time of the initial reporting.
And so this company will keep getting paid for more information.
Will get more and more and more money the lower the stock goes.
I'm tempted to ask what James Madison would say.
What would James Madison say?
I think James Madison would say, "What's a pacemaker?"
Excellent. What's cybersecurity?
That's true. All right.
And did short sales exist then?
Ooh, that's a good question. In the times of the founding fathers, did short sales exist? Did we have exchanges at the time of the...
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, people bought stock in companies, right?
Absolutely.
James Madison would totally have short sale position, right? He's a smart guy.
He was a short guy.
I mean, there's literally a book on the shelf right now that says, "What would Madison do?" right above your head.
That's true.
There's like about 6 copies, so we'll get back to you.
But there is not a chapter either on cybersecurity, short sales, or pacemakers.
No. Time for volume 2.
Exactly. And time for wordplay number 3. Oh, that was terrible. All right, so it was announced yesterday that the United States... we think it was the United States anyway. It was either the United States or Russia. Both are claiming that they killed the number 2 top official in ISIS, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, who had worn a number of hats, kind of a deputy ISIS figure, an operational figure, a spokesperson.
Boom.
Boom.
Not wearing hats anymore.
That was your last tweet.
Ooh.
All those hats are gone. Burned up. This was actually probably, I think it's fair to say, probably the most high profile, highest level targeted killing of an ISIS member. I mean, if it's either him or Baghdadi. It was greeted by a lot of people in the defense establishment and some members of Congress as a sign that, look, the war against ISIS is making progress. If we're now able to isolate the number two guy in the organization, who presumably was going to some length to try and keep away from the business end of a Hellfire missile, that's good. The intelligence is good. The organization's crumbling. There's also the counterargument, which is that the number two will just be replaced by the number three, and then the number three guy will be replaced by the number four, and that really the networked structure of a terrorist organization makes these kinds of hierarchical, strikes really not as meaningful as they would be if you were taking out, a deputy commander in chief or, a vice president of a country. I don't know. Should we be selling? I mean, we should obviously be. It's obviously good news in terms of the war against ISIS, but ISIS is a pretty resilient organization and pretty crafty.
Well, so I guess there are a few different lines of argument, I guess, conflated in the discussion around the meaning of Adnani's death. There's the decapitation strategy, and how effective is that? And certainly the U.S. government claims that it is a core part of its strategy, and it is very effective, and they've killed a lot of ISIS leaders, and this is a very senior one and therefore very important. I think symbolically, this particular decapitation might be more important because it seems as though Adnani was recognized by at least some in ISIS as eligible to succeed al-Baghdadi as caliph. And so symbolically in the sort of the religious ideology of ISIS, it's meaningful and it's a blow. And of course, the fact that they had sufficient operational intelligence to deliberately target him and get him, if in fact they did, not only says something good about American intelligence, but it also
Russian intelligence.
Or Russian intelligence. But it also likely makes some of these ISIS guys run a little scared or feel a little more mistrustful about those around them, and that's going to hamper their operational capacity. But at the end of the day, I think we have a problem that we've discussed on the show a number of times, which is that, the starting out premise of the campaign against ISIS is that the territorial base of this organization is meaningful. It's a source of power. It's an indicator of its strength. And that if we can diminish its territorial capability and the number of people fighting for it, we can weaken and ultimately destroy it. And what we've seen is that ISIS has adapted to our strategy in part by conducting out-of-area operations that have been very costly and that have targeted Westerners, Western capitals, Western targets. And so every time we have a victory like this, my immediate thought is, oh crap, now they're going to go bomb another European city.
Right, but I do think it's notable that the decapitation strategy is not alike with regards to different types of people, right? So there are some roles that appear to be, when occupied by positions of individuals with particular charisma or ingenuity, actually their role itself and their sort of personal existence does appear to have sort of an outsized influence, and it seems like this might be one of those cases. So Adnani was sort of the propagandist, right? Sort of the person who had who has been most effective in issuing this call of sort of weaponizing ISIS aspirants or sort of around the world, right? Of attack people in the West, attack them with a rock or a car or whatever you can, and that he's been very successful in sort of mounting that message and spreading it. And so I do think it's possible that there isn't going to be sort of the next person to step into those shoes who will be quite as effective.
I also think that, I agree that ISIS is adaptable and adapting and behaving differently. But I don't think that we should conclude from that, it's not good to kill its leadership and to reduce its territory because then they'll turn into a regular terrorist organization and do bad things in Paris. You know, they were doing bad things in Paris, even before this strike killed their leader, one of their leaders. And so, I think right now they're an organization that controls a lot of territory and conducts overseas operations. And if we can take away some of that territory and kill some of their leaders, and then they can only do bombings, and, you know, that is a better situation than if millions of people have to live under them and they're a threat to the Iraqi governments.
You know, you're right, but you live in a dark, dark world, Ben.
I think one of the most interesting parts of this, though, is that the Russians are trying to claim credit for it, right?
Yeah.
So the Russians posted essentially saying, you know, we killed.
Terminated.
Exactly. And the Pentagon released a statement that basically was like hell you did.
Yeah.
I just think that's
sort
of
we're vying for credit.
Well, chest thumping.
And I sort of actually, I think I sort of approve in a way of that kind of gloating, maybe is the wrong word, but taking credit for it insofar as when you're fighting an organization that clearly is an ideology now expressed as this movement that has made such amazing, and I don't use that in a complimentary way, use of propaganda, you can kind of fight fire with fire here. And there have been a lot of people who've said, look, that the way to actually counter the ISIS message, particularly if it's in social media or in communities that are susceptible to being radicalized or recruited, is to humiliate ISIS. It's to condemn them. It's to say they have a terrible message. And, you know, one way maybe of doing this is saying, you know, you're not so tough after all. We found your number two. And by the way, number one, we're coming for you too. And I mean, it's not really in this administration's nature to gloat in that way or to be threatening. I think a Trump administration would probably be, he'd be tweeting all kinds of things
Brett
about
McGurk,
it.
Brett McGurk, who is the head of the U.S. head of the, or envoy to the Coalition to Defeat ISIS, does a lot of gloating on Twitter and in public statements about U.S. and coalition achievements against
ISIS. That's kind of maybe his role then.
Yeah. He's the gloater in chief.
Yeah. So
do you think not that, in chief.
And do you think that resonates? I mean, am I being too like short-sighted in thinking that that's actually going to be a message that people who we want to reach are going to be moved by?
I've always found it puzzling, actually, and I've assumed that it is a deliberate choice on his part or his team's part, because they think it's somehow effective either in rallying our allies or humiliating our enemies. But it's always rung so oddly to me to have a U.S. official, a diplomat, someone from the State Department, tweet things like coalition forces crush ISIS or just, you know, roll over ISIS forces as he regularly does.
Sure, right. Feels good though.
No, I mean, look, that sort of like machismo, I always want to roll my eyes at. That said, like, you're talking to different audiences.
Hillary
right?
Clinton would totally do that, by the way.
She probably would.
She would.
Yeah.
She'd
chest bump someone.
She'd be badass. She'd be on there. She'd have like a little like emoticon with like a little bomb.
But look, I do think
she can't use cell phones anymore. Who are we kidding? Those days are over. I'm sorry.
She uses Snapchat.
I hope not.
No, she even posted about it. She said those those messages disappear without my having to do anything.
Anyway, Susan.
I totally lost my train. I'm going to have to edit this.
Well, you can stick in here the clip of Hillary Clinton saying those.
Yeah, the
did
thing
she
about
actually
the
say that?
Yeah, she actually did. It was months ago.
Laugh.
Look, I do think it's notable, sort of, and worthwhile to underscore the U.S.'s superior capacities here. I think that's an important message, and I think it's one of the reasons why the Pentagon didn't just say that he was killed in an airstrike, but that he was targeted and killed in an airstrike, right? That really is the message of, we were looking for you, we found you, we knew where you were, and we killed you.
Yeah, we got you.
And by the way, all people around the world that think that they're going to go, you know, to Syria to fight on behalf of ISIS, that's not going to happen, or this is what's going to happen to you as well. I think that a little bit, for example, the duration of time between 9/11 and actually killing Osama bin Laden, I think those sort of narratives do emerge about, you know, look, the inept West, and it's sort of it's too big to really do anything, and that does feed into sort of a particular narrative about the United States. And so I do, I could live without, honestly, diplomats on Twitter ever in any capacity. But I do think that it serves at least somewhat of a useful role.
We do big things. Damn it.
We blow people up. Damn we it. Rain death from the sky.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
There's probably something in the Geneva Conventions that says that's a no-no, right?
So there's that great cartoon that used to hang on Cody Poplin's wall. It's the it's the Constitutional Convention, and the caption reads, "And of course we should give the executive the power to rain death from electronic drones in the sky."
They were very foresighted. Yeah. That James Madison. He knew what he was up to. All right, let's move on to object lessons. I'll actually go first. This is my object. It's actually a photo. I could not bring it in because it's quite the artifact and quite heavy. This is a compass computer, or made by a grid compass.
I remember the grid compass.
The grid compass was a very early laptop, essentially, kind of with a clamshell design and a keyboard and this wonderful glowing orange screen. And the visionary behind this, who designed it, John Ellenby, died last week. And I first actually came to know about the grid compass when I was working on my first book, The Watchers, because John Poindexter, who was the subject of that book, had a grid compass.
Wow.
And he would bring it home, and it was like his, you know, it was like his prototype laptop, and he did all kinds of stuff to re-engineer the White House email system, which was, did some fun stuff with that later, from a grid compass. And he told me all about it when I interviewed him. And John Markoff, in his lovely obituary to Ellenby in the Times, talks about Poindexter being a user of this. But it was carried into space. It was actually on the Challenger, one of these, when it blew up, and survived the impact.
Amazing.
Wow. Yeah. So this is something that has been an early laptop, the design of which we've all benefited from, but had a real sort of starring role in national security in the 80s when it was developed.
I remember the
grid, and hugely expensive.
I remember the grid compass from when I was in high school, and it seemed so wildly cool and futuristic.
Yeah, really, and space age.
And I remember there were two things, like computers, that I read about, that, like, I never saw one, but read about at that. One was the Cray supercomputer, and the other was the grid compass. And they were, you know, like these...
the super big and the super small.
Yeah, and they were both, like, they're probably less powerful than... the grid compass is probably less powerful than my iPhone now.
But, oh, by a long shot,
But it could do all these things, and it had... You know, and it looked like it belonged on a spaceship. And yeah, so rest in peace.
Yeah. Who wants to go next? Who else has objects?
I have an object other than Jen.
We're all objectifying Jen today.
Yeah, we are objectifying Jen. My object is the syllabus for the course that I'm going to be teaching tomorrow. Which I'm
beginning tomorrow.
Beginning tomorrow, yeah. I'm teaching.
It's Thursday. You'll start. You know,
and if anybody wants to, you know, just sort of show up,
you'll take anyone. You know, pay. Settle that with someone else.
Yeah, that's not my department. So Georgetown School of Foreign Service asked me to teach a course on law and national security. And so in honor of Wells Bennett, who you guys may remember from when he used to guest on this show, Wells, when he left Lawfare and Rational Security, gave me the Handmaiden of Power Award, which hangs proudly on my wall and of which you've heard on this show before. And so in honor of that, we named this course Handmaidens of Power, an introduction to law and national security. And it is all framed for the young, would-be handmaidens of power.
You named this course sarcastically, but the students are going to take it seriously.
So here's the thing. I tweeted the name of the course, and directed the tweet at Glenn Greenwald to try to bait him into responding and taking it seriously. And then I started my stopwatch to see how long it would take him to do it. And it was within 40 minutes, Glenn had tweeted that this was the perfect name for a course taught by me. And he said, "Good job." My object lesson is the course entry, Handmaidens of Power, an introduction to law and national security, and the overly earnest, predictable response by Glenn Greenwald.
But you wanted that.
Oh, I so wanted it. I was just an effort to see if I could get him to do it.
And is he going to guest lecture?
No.
Oh, he should.
Yeah. I'd happily have him guest lecture.
That'd be awesome.
But he doesn't
open
come to...
Open invitation to Glenn Greenwald.
No, Ben, you need to have him and like on Skype and then like the little robot Snowden.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they'd agree to come teach my class. No. They don't like me very much.
No, but that's the whole point, is they would want an opportunity to, you know, clean up these young impressionable minds that you are polluting.
How do you
the
say
future
handmaiden
of the Foreign
in Russian?
Service?
I don't know. Nor do I know how to say it in Portuguese.
they just have to teach a different class, a different version of the class.
Well, good luck to you and your future students.
Seriously, especially Godspeed, guys.
I believe that children are our future. That brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find a link to our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. And please remember to rate and review the podcast when you download it on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. We really appreciate it and helps others find out about the show. Remember to follow us on security at RATL Security. I think after now that the summer's over, we'll get back with some listener questions, hopefully. I would love to actually do a show that was largely about listener questions again. That's been really fun.
Or listener rants, but they can only be 140 characters each.
Yeah, exactly.
Or listener personal insults.
Ooh, what's, oh,
let's... Whatever.
Direct marriage proposals.
Direct those at Ben, too. but we look forward
to... We'll direct those to Sophia.
exactly. The podcast is edited, of course, by Jen Howell, who thanks again for being here, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
Have you already decided what you're going to cut out of this podcast?
Absolutely.
Awesome. It's like, it's going to be about 20 minutes shorter. Our music was performed this week by Muddy Waters and the Short Tickers.
Ooh, very
right,
good.
Pretty good. Like You're back.
You like that? I'm back. It's not even Labor Day yet. No, of course, our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan, who, best I know it, does not have a pacemaker, is not a hacker.
And is not a handmaiden in power.
Is not, definitely not a handmaiden
in
power.
But is open to your proposals on Twitter.
Yes. Send them her way. Oh, she's going to be so happy.
Sorry, Sophia.
On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes, Susan Hennessy, Tamar Kaufman Wittes, and Jen Howell, thank you all for listening. We will talk to you next week.